In the Canadian justice system, animals' interests are rarely represented, but the lawyers at Animal Justice fight to give them a voice in court and the political system. This is the Paw and Order Podcast, and these are their stories.
Hello and welcome. It's episode 7 of Paw and Order. I'm Peter Sankoff, your host, calling in from Edmonton, Alberta. I'm here today with my co-host, Camille Lapchuk.
Hi, Peter. I'm here in Ottawa.
How you doing over there?
Oh, not so bad. It's still freezing cold here. We still haven't had much of a spring to speak of, but I guess we do live in Canada, so no surprises.
We're enjoying balmy spring temperatures here. This morning, I was absolutely delighted. I woke up. I got to walk to work in minus one today. You've never seen someone so happy. it's been like minus 10 or lower all week.
Wow. Yeah.
In completely unrelated news, I have to tell you that the Paw and Order podcast is about to go under as I make my move to essentially anywhere warmer on the planet.
So I know, and I know
I have to leave everything I have.
I know it's so Canadian to talk about the weather, but it's just so ever-present in our daily lives. And I always wonder why we ended up living in a country where you can literally die if you stay outside for too long.
I think I have a reasonable view of the weather. I essentially have a single rule. I'm not even kidding. I don't really care what the weather is like. And I live in Edmonton, so it's really bad. I only have one request. I don't want winter to last 6 months. I think 6 months is inhumane. So, I mean, in the past few years, we've managed to get through Edmonton with like 4 months, 4.5 months. And this year we are heading towards our we're getting to 6 months with no end in sight. We're already at 5.5 months and there's still like 3 feet to snow on the ground.
Yeah, that is basically the same thing here. Last weekend was my birthday, April 7th, and my birthday is usually a pretty good
Woo-hoo!
Metric. Woohoo! My birthday's
happy birthday, Camille.
Thank you. This time of year, it's usually a pretty good metric for me of like, oh, is it spring yet? Because I can always sort of remember like what the weather was like on my birthday. And this year it was minus one. There was a skiff of snow. And I can honestly say it's been one of those bad years for birthday weather. But I did have a fun party.
Cry me a river. I'm in the middle of December. So like, you know, I got the benefit of living 10 years in New Zealand. So for 10 years, I had summer birthdays and it was like the best thing ever. So all you people with April, May, June birthdays, like cry me a river, Camille.
Seriously. Yeah, I guess at least we have some shot at reasonable weather. But I did have a fun birthday party, Peter. I wish you could have come.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Me too. I heard you, you ended up with like that no good Michael Spratt from, The Docket podcast. God, I can't believe you let him in your house. How did that happen?
I know. You invite these things and Riff Raff shows up. But despite Michael Spratt being there, the birthday party was really fun. I made a ton of stuff from this new cookbook that I bought recently. It's called Hot for Food. It's by cookbook author Lauren Toyota, who's a popular YouTube host and is just a genius in the kitchen. So I made jalapeno poppers and this buffalo chicken dip, which was crazy good, and also like a 4-layer hazelnut torte. All vegan, obviously.
Wow.
So I wish you could have been there, Peter.
Me too, Camille. Nothing says it's your birthday like cooking for 25 people. Congratulations to you. I'm glad you really took it easy.
Yeah, to each their own, right? So, Peter, I understand, speaking of Michael Spratt, I understand you were chatting with him recently too.
Yes, I was chatting with Michael Spratt. I decided I wasn't doing enough podcasting here, so apparently I had to go on and do another podcast. I did a fun podcast on The Docket where we talked about criminal justice. And that was a lot of fun. I always have a good time on The Docket.
Yeah, we were kind of complaining a little bit in the last episode, I think, about this new bill that the government put forward, C-75. But I understand that's what you guys were complaining about on The Docket, which is always fun. I am so annoyed by that bill, too, for all kinds of reasons, like mostly criminal law reasons, since it's a criminal law bill and I used to practice criminal law. So one thing it does is probably decimates the whole legal aid clinic system where students can represent clients charged with criminal offenses. It makes some changes that affect that, and all these new rules about police being able to introduce evidence in really disturbing ways and other stuff, too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's tons of criminal stuff. And for that, I urge you to go talk to go check out the docket where we talked about all these changes in great detail with our friends Michael Spratt and Emily Tammen. But Bill C-75, we want to talk about it here a little bit, to talk about the animal law aspects, because there are, I would say, a couple of aspects. I would say three things touching on animal law in the bill. I'd say two of them good and, well, at least potentially good for animals, and one of them bad. Where should we start, Camille, with the bad or the good?
Oh, well, let's give people a little bit of something to hope for. What's the good news, Peter?
I'd say there are two good things in there for animals, and I think they're tucked in. I don't think they are things that you would normally think of as being good for animals, but nonetheless, I do think that they are good for animals. So animal lovers, if Bill C-75 passes, while I am not a big fan of this bill for criminal law purposes, it does have some good things about animals. And let's talk about the first thing, which I think is actually the best thing, is it is changing the structure of summary conviction offenses. And summary conviction offenses are essentially the less serious crimes that people commit, and they get prosecuted in a more summary fashion. They're tried before provincial court judges, and they are deemed to be less significant. And when you're talking less significant, really, we could just substitute animal cruelty, because we know how prosecutors treat animal cruelty offenses. And in fact, I've never really seen a criminal law an animal cruelty offense prosecuted by the more serious procedure by indictment. So any changes to the summary conviction offense structure is going to affect animal cruelty offenses. And one of those, in my opinion, is a very positive change. Up right now, as of today, the way it works for summary conviction offenses is there is a limitation period on those offenses, and the limitation period is 6 months. Now, Camille, between you and I think you know that sometimes one of the problems with prosecuting animal cruelty offending under the criminal code is this 6-month limitation period is a problem, is it not?
Oh, it's a huge problem. I mean, if you just think about the amount of effort involved in investigating animal cruelty allegations, you know, sometimes it's a straightforward case where somebody strangles or kicks a dog, and that can be pretty straightforward. But maybe we're talking about an undercover investigation like the one in Chilliwack, British Columbia, where a bunch of individuals were seen on camera abusing cows over an extended period of time at a dairy farm. I mean, Peter, the Crown in that case, and the investigators recommended charges at a certain point, but I think it took 21 months before there was a decision about whether charges would be laid?
Yeah, absolutely. These things can take a lot of time. And frankly, a lot of times the investigation just stalls or doesn't happen altogether because the offending is found out to be historical and it's beyond the 6-month limitation period. And that 6 months can really drive every aspect of the investigation. It really does. Sometimes the investigation has to be rushed because you're concerned about the 6-month limit. And I think that's really problematic. Yeah.
Yeah, it can be incredibly bad if you're not able to do an effective investigation because you're just up against this time limit all the time. So you think this is actually potentially going to be good?
Yeah, well, because what's happened is they're upping the limitation period to 1 year. So they're trying to make it more flexible and a little bit easier to prosecute all sorts of summary conviction offenses. And I think this is an excellent change. I think it's a long time in coming. I think we've recognized that offending as summary conviction offenses become more and more serious, in the sense that, as you'll hear in a moment, we're also upping the penalty. It makes sense to give prosecutorial and investigation authorities more time to look into these things properly. And seriously, like a 1-year limitation period, the whole idea of having a limitation period at all is to give people a sense of finality, that when they do something, they don't have to be looking over their shoulders for the rest of their life knowing that a criminal charge might be coming. And I think that what's interesting about this in this case is the 6-month period was really tough. And by making it up to 1 year, you're still keeping it at a reasonable limit, but allowing authorities to do their jobs. And I think that's really important. And I should probably add on this, Camille, that most of the provincial provincial prosecutorial authorities, or most of the provincial animal protection acts, are also capped at 6 months. It's an interesting thing. The OSPCA Act is also capped the limitation period at 6 months. And I think what would be interesting to see is whether the province has recognized that this one-year thing is more flexible and allows a little bit a better degree of offending. And it wouldn't surprise me if the provinces follow suit and also extend their limitation periods to 1 year. And by and large, that would all be good for the investigation of animal cruelty offenses.
That's a really interesting idea, Peter. And if any listeners are interested in learning more about this, the difference between prosecutions under the criminal code and prosecutions under provincial legislation, you can check out episode 2 of Paw and Order, where we go over these federalism issues, these different levels of government in some detail. And Peter, obviously, you and I have both been concerned for quite some time about this whole shift of prosecutions towards the provincial realm. So they're less serious offenses when we're talking about provincial offenses. They're more regulatory offenses. So this could be really good in terms of encouraging more criminal prosecutions instead of provincial ones if the limitation period for criminal offenses is upped in this way. It might actually result in more criminal cases.
Yeah, that's definitely a good one. And the second change that I think is of interest to everybody, I mean, certainly, is that sentences are going up. Now, here's what's interesting about sentences going up. The way in which the bill is structured is it's really designed to be an efficiency bill. So what's happening right now is the criminal code is littered with hundreds of offenses, and all of them have their own particular penalties. And I can tell you that for the summary conviction offenses that we're talking about, the penalties range from a maximum, and let me just stress these are maximum sentences, of 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. And they're just littered throughout the code, and they're all different. Well, what's going to happen now is that the offenses are all going to be standardized, and every summary conviction offense is going to be at a 2-year maximum penalty. Well, that again is good for animal cruelty offending, because as I suggested, animal cruelty offending is almost always prosecuted by summary conviction. And essentially what's happening is the maximum penalty is raising from 18 months to 2 years. And again, that wasn't directly done for any reason related to animal cruelty, but nonetheless, there will be a bump up in these sentences, and I think that could have a real impact on the nature of sentences handed out, because judges are now looking at offending from, you know, nothing when they punish somebody up to 2 years, whereas before, it was limited to 18 months. So we have some interesting stuff coming out of Bill C-75 that is of use for animals.
Yeah, no, you know, it's so interesting, too, when we talk about animal cruelty offenses, when big cases hit the news, like, say, the veterinarian in St. Catharines, or this poor dog recently in Duncan, BC, who was found in just horrific conditions, people always call for blood. They want the maximum sentence to be imposed. And, you know, I know that affects judges in some ways when they come to their sentencing decision. You can't ignore that societal context. So it will be really interesting to see if this translates into longer sentences long term.
Absolutely. Now, Camille, I told you it was all good. I mean, it's funny, we had two changes, neither one of them directed at animals, and they both happen to be fairly good for animal cruelty prosecutions. But with the good comes the bad when we're dealing with the Liberal government, right, Camille?
Oh, I think you can say that on the criminal law file for sure. And, you know, on the animal law file, it's been mostly all bad news. So, you know, I guess that's what we should be expecting. So, Peter, what is this bad news?
Well, the bad news is there was nothing done to fix the animal cruelty provisions of the code, and I think that's an absolute disgrace, and I think it is something for which the Liberal government should be held to account, and I'm going to raise two matters that have been front and center on their attention span, which the Liberal government consistently refuses to fix. The first are the bestiality provisions of the code, Camille. We know about those, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And guests, our listeners, we are still promising to do a special episode on bestiality, which I'm sure you'll all listen to eagerly. But everyone, I think, probably
nothing.
Knows
nothing brings in the listeners, Camille, like bestiality.
Oh,
I promise
no.
You, it's going to be our most listened to episode.
I'm not even shy about talking about it anymore, just because we've had to deal with this for so long. But it's so inherently awful and awkward. But listeners may remember that Peter and I went to the Supreme Court to intervene in this really important case called the Queen and DLW, where the whole issue of interpreting our bestiality laws was at stake. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, you know what? The laws as written are, you know, essentially so outdated and bad that they only cover penetrative sexual contact with animals. All sexual contact that falls short of penetration is not a criminal offense. So, Peter, this is obviously a huge loophole.
It's a bit of a loophole. And, you know, obviously the Supreme Court said, well, Parliament, you know, if they want to fix it, they should. And in fact, I think they even hinted that Parliament should go out and fix it. But I mean, Camille, perhaps we're being too harsh. I mean, Parliament's really had no time whatsoever to study this. I mean, and honestly, it's a very complicated reform, isn't it, Camille?
Yeah, you know, Peter, and I hope you can hear my sarcasm dripping through, it requires a whole 9-word amendment to the criminal code, something that's already been put forward now in 2 private members' bills. So Nathaniel Erskine Smith's bill, C-246, it just proposes a definition of the word bestiality that penalizes all sexual contact with animals. So that was number one. And number two, most recently, Conservative MP Michelle Rempel put a standalone bill out there on bestiality that does exactly the same thing. So they know what needs to be done. It's just a matter of the political willpower to do it.
Yeah, because Camille, I mean, there is, in fairness, this could divide Parliament. I mean, there is a lot of support out there for bestiality as it exists. I mean, really, Camille, this is a tough one. I don't, you know, we got to cut the Liberals some slack here.
Sarcasm alert. Yeah, apparently there's some big constituency of bestiality aficionados that are leaning on the Liberals really heavily, because I can't think of any other explanation for this.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's disgusting. It is really a complete and utter disgrace. And I don't know who to call out from the Liberal government, but I have absolutely no idea why they are refusing in a bill where they are trying to clean up matters related to the criminal code that they could not sneak in a reform to the bestiality provisions. So I call it complete BS. I don't know what it is that they're doing, but I think the Liberal government needs to be called to task for refusing to take a simple amendment to redact essentially to deal with a Supreme Court decision in which the Supreme Court almost apologetically said, well, we're going to deal with your historical views of bestiality, Parliament, because you haven't actually told us otherwise. Really, really disgraceful and disappointing, quite frankly.
Yeah, you know what? And it's also now been 22 months since that Supreme Court decision came out. It was June of 2016. So it's not like they haven't had time.
Yes, and they've had time for other things too, Camille, because I like to notice that when Bill C-75 was passed, it was passed by, of course, our Minister of Justice and the Deputy Parliamentary Undersecretary for the Minister of Justice, who just so happens to be Bill Blair. Does that name ring a bell to you, Camille? Bill Blair in connection with animal cruelty?
Yeah, former Toronto police chief. He was heavily involved in the criminal justice system for many years.
Oh, and he was heavily involved in something else, Camille, because a couple of years ago, I believe it was just around this time, 2 years ago in 2016, when Nathaniel Erskine Smith decided to bring a private member's bill before the House called Bill C-246 that would have made some very constructive amendments to the animal cruelty provisions of the code. That bill was essentially torpedoed, Camille. And do you remember who torpedoed that bill?
Yeah, in fact, it was the government and the justice minister, and specifically Bill Blair stood up in the House of Commons to say, well, yeah, sorry, we're not going to support this because we think there should be wholesale criminal code reform. And of course, the government's committed to doing something on animals in that context.
I sometimes worry, Camille. I sometimes worry that we are accused of being unfair to politicians and that we are paraphrasing them and perhaps taking their words out of context, Camille. So shame on you for misconstruing Bill Blair's words. I just so happen in front of me to have Bill Blair's actual speech. Would you like me to read it, Camille? Because I want to read it as seriously as I can to let Mr. Blair's words speak for himself. You ready? Here is Mr. Blair's decision to vote down Bill C-246, all right? And this is 2 years ago in 2016. And keep in mind that last week, the Liberal government decided to release a major criminal reform bill. And I can promise you, ladies and gentlemen, let me give you my promise. I don't promise things about politicians very often, but I promise you, there will be no other criminal code justice reform bill during this government's mandate. Is that a fair thing to say, Camille?
Yeah, I just can't see it. They're getting too close to an election, and no government wants to mess with criminal laws close to an election, because then you get people saying, oh, you're soft on crime.
They're already doing it. Like, so I just don't see another bill. But anyway, let's go back in time. Let's do our little time machine here. 2016, Bill Blair decides to talk about criminal law, and here's what he says. I agree that the animal cruelty regime does merit significant reform, and I would like to take the opportunity to applaud and commend my colleague from Beaches East York, that's Nathaniel Erskine Smith, for his strong efforts and advocacy in bringing this important matter forward. I do, however, believe that there is going to be a larger review of the criminal code taking place under the mandate of the Justice Minister, and I believe that the changes to the animal protections in that code should be the subject of broad public consultations prior to moving forward. Isn't that awesome, Camille?
Wow. It's fantastic. Sounds really good on paper.
Camille, as it turns out, I have found out when those broad public consultations are going to start. It turns out that they are starting on the 12th of never, Camille. That is the date that is scheduled for the animal cruelty reforms to begin taking place with broad public consultations. It's just insulting. It's absolutely ridiculous. It insults the intelligence of everyone who's trying to bring these sensible reforms forward, and to kill it for that reason, effectively. And of course, the Liberal government, you know, wholeheartedly joined hands to vote this bill down. It's just disingenuous, and it's absolutely troubling that there is absolutely no move in the cards to move these things forward. So if you want to talk about Bill C-75 being a disappointment, Camille, that to me is the biggest reason.
Yeah, no, it's like, honestly embarrasses me and keeps me up at night that Canada has such bad animal cruelty laws. We are one of the, you know, most modern nations in the world. We pride ourselves on being kind and compassionate. We like to think of ourselves that way, yet we can't even get modest reforms passed to fix our atrocious animal cruelty laws. Like, what?
Wow, it's fantastic. Well, we got to move on, Camille. Let me tell you this. So we have three items we want to touch on here. And honestly, any one of these three items could have been our hero of the month. It was a good week for heroes, wouldn't you say, Camille?
Yeah. I think there was some really positive stuff happening in the last little while.
I think so, too. And I just want to say these three items, essentially, that's what they have in common, is that they really all could have been heroes. So think of these next three items as our almost heroes, only because, as you will hear when we get to Heroes and Zeros, our hero of the month is pretty special. But I want to touch it off by tossing it over to you, Camille. There was a wonderful Globe and Mail op-ed last week, I believe, that we want to give a shout out to. Camille, you want to tell us about it?
Yeah, so our good friend, I guess we can call her a friend of the podcast. I know she listens. Jessica Smart.
I don't think she's a friend of the podcast. Let me object right now. Friend of the podcast requires someone to actually do something for the podcast. So sorry, Jessica. You are only a friend to Camille. I've never met you, so you can't be my friend either. But definitely not a friend of the podcast yet.
All right. I guess that has to be earned. But a good friend of animal justice, Jessica Scott Reed, she wrote a great piece in the Globe and Mail about humane washing. And this is exactly what we spoke about in our last episode, is false advertising, making inflated claims about how well companies treat their animals and why those claims never really pan out. So Jess wrote this fabulous piece in the Globe and Mail. We'll link to it in the show notes about exactly why that's the case. And we got a little shout out for animal justice, too. So really great to see that in the pages of the national newspaper.
Yeah, I think it was an awesome piece. I really think it's important to call out situations in which people are trying to be something they're not and trying to portray themselves as humane companies when really they're humane washing, which is trying to do one thing nice on one side and something horrible on the other. So I agree, Camille. Really good work by Jessica on that one.
Definitely. And Peter, there was a really amazing report out of New Zealand about rodeos. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to the New Zealand Animal Law Association, which is a group that's near and dear to my heart. They started up just as I was leaving New Zealand, but a good friend of mine, Danielle Duffield, was the originator of this group, and she really propelled it into existence. And they have come out with their first ever report, and I think that's a really important thing to do. They've essentially looked at the state of rodeo in New Zealand, and let me just say that if you think, Camille, that rodeo is a made-up cultural import to Canada, good God, like, talk about a place where it has no existence whatsoever is in New Zealand. But nonetheless, they go out and do all sorts of rodeo sports. And the New Zealand Animal Law Association did a wonderful piece of work. I urge you, we'll link to it in the show notes, that really evaluates the state of rodeo and its legal status in New Zealand and makes some really compelling claims about why it should not be allowed there.
Yeah. And, you know, Peter, I was also shocked to learn that rodeo was a thing in New Zealand because, like, why would it be? There's no Western culture there in the same way that we sort of used to justify the stampede and other cruelty in Canada. But I think this idea that rodeo events might be illegal is really taking a foothold, not just in Canada, apparently, but also in New Zealand. So when you look about, or when you look at our laws about unnecessary cruelty, that's, or unnecessary suffering, that's something that we consider to be an offense. And what could be more unnecessary than subjecting animals just to horrific pain and suffering for the sake of entertainment, which is all that rodeo events truly are. It's just pleasing the crowds, pleasing the masses.
Yeah, absolutely. And the report is a good one. I urge people to take a look at it. So another good shout out there to the New Zealand Animal Law Association. And finally, we want to make a shout out to the city of San Francisco.
Woohoo! So this actually happened a little while ago, but we haven't touched on it yet. So there's no time like the present. San Francisco just banned future sales of fur. I forget when the law comes into effect, but there is sort of a grace period where companies that still have fur in their stocks can sell it up until a certain point. And after that, there's no more fur sales in the city, which is just incredible because San Fran is one of the US's major cities. There's two other places that have done this so far, West Hollywood and also Berkeley. So obviously those are, you know, wonderful achievements, but nowhere near on the same scale as San Francisco. And Peter, I don't know if you've been noticing this, but just everyone online is just abuzz about this. And it really seems to have tipped the momentum in the right direction. I've also noticed that there's just tons of designers lately that are saying that they're no longer going to use fur. And you can't help but wonder if San Francisco's really strong market signal is a nod in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, any of these changes with bans are interesting. I'm always curious to see what's going to happen if various companies are going to try and challenge this in court. I'm interested in how those court cases, assuming they go forward, actually get resolved. But I mean, I think it's great that cities are taking proactive measures on this. And certainly it heralds a change for things going forward.
Yeah, and you know what? Honestly, Peter, I hope they do try to challenge these cases because every time an industry tries to challenge a progressive law, it gives animal advocates an opportunity to talk about why that industry is bad for animals and needs to go. So you can just imagine the kinds of information that will be presented in that court case if it goes forward and in the media about just the absolute suffering that the fur industry causes through fur farms and trapping and hunting.
Absolutely. Now, Camille, before we head into our main segment, I know that there's also been some big news in animal justice. I believe a web page went live the other day, correct?
That's right. So we spoke last week about the gala that we're planning for June 8th, which is our 10-year anniversary gala, believe it or not. And that's going to take place in Toronto at this gorgeous venue called The Burrows, right downtown, Queen and Bathurst. So, Peter, yesterday we put up the website and opened up ticket sales officially to the public. And I can tell you that almost a third of the tickets are already gone. So it's just been like they've been flying off the shelves, which is amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. So if you're listening
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you're listening and you want a ticket, I would not sit on my hands for too much longer because I do expect that they're going to sell out well in advance of the event and we wouldn't want to miss having you there.
Absolutely. We want Paw and Order listeners there. In fact, I'm going to be there and everybody who comes up and says hello to me, I heard you on Paw and Order. I'm going to make a special donation to Animal Justice that night on your behalf. If you come up to me, you have to say, I listened to you on Paw and Order. I'll be very excited. Come on over.
We'll even pose for pictures with listeners.
Oh my God, that would be my pleasure. I would love nothing more. I'm always convinced, Camille, even though I you know, I do keep an eye on download numbers and I do hear from people, I'm just convinced that, you know, you put these podcasts together and they go off into the void and I'm like, nobody is ever listening. And I know that's not true. So it's always nice when it materializes into real faces. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so all we're saying is keep sending us emails, keep that feedback coming, keep asking questions. We love to hear from you.
All right, now today's main segment, we're going to go on to today's main segment, and I can tell you that today's main segment is a special one. Camille, we've had our first guest ever on Paw and Order. I'm very excited about it, aren't you?
I'm super jazzed about it. And this is such a cool topic, too, and one that's been in the news so much recently. Do you want to tell people what it is?
I'll tell people what it is. Camille hasn't heard it yet. I did an interview with Alana Devine. She is the executive director of the Montreal SPCA, and she is leading the fight against breed-specific legislation. And I'm very excited to hear her views about what is going on, the Battle of Quebec over breed-specific legislation. So it's really important to have Alana on here today, and we're very excited to hear from her.
Can't wait. And just one thing, Alana's actually director of animal advocacy.
You know, as I was about to say, we need a quick edit. I was going to redo that segment, but I think you fixed it for us. As I said, as the words came out of my mouth, I realized, wait a minute, I've just misstated Alana's title, and that's terrible. But don't worry, I promise you, in the interview, I get it right.
Excellent.
All right. I am here today with the first guest we've ever had on Paw and Order. So that right away is an illustrious distinction, with an old friend of mine, Alana Devine, calling in from Montreal. Alana is the Director of Animal Advocacy at the Montreal SPCA. Alana, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to be on the show today.
Well, we are very excited to have you. We've been carefully plotting who our first guest was going to be, and after meticulous thought and consideration, we came around to you. Actually, that's not true. We really wanted a guest on today, and it turns out Quebec was in the news.
Or you picked a name out of a hat, and mine came out.
You were the first person to take our call, Alana. Let's be honest. We had so many people turning us down, saying, "What the hell is this podcast?"
No, nonetheless, anyway, I am honored.
We are thrilled to have us. You will go down in the annals of Paw and Order history as our first ever guest. So we're delighted to have you, Alana. The reason we wanted to have you on is because I think it's fair to say that Montreal, and I guess Quebec more generally, have been on the forefront of one of the biggest animal law issues being waged in Canada at this time, and that deals with breed-specific... Oh, it's the real-life SPCA we're hearing over the audio.
It is. Sorry about that. You're going to hear intercom, dogs barking... The rooster we have living on our floor certainly making a ruckus at some point. My apologies.
We will. If I don't get to hear the rooster, I'll be particularly disappointed. We are. Anyway, to finish up that thought, the issue of the day being dealt with in Quebec is breed-specific legislation. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in Quebec right now?
Sure. So this is a situation that we've been dealing with on a very proactive / reactive basis for the last year and a half or so. In short, there was a tragic death of a woman in Montreal in June 2016. And following the death of this woman, she was killed by a dog. The media went wild and pointing out that the dog was potentially a quote-unquote, we can talk about why I use air quotes around that term, pit bull. And the city of Montreal, immediately after this death occurred, announced that they would be adopting breed-specific legislation in the city of Montreal. And so that's sort of how this whole thing unfolded. One death, you know, there's been only about 8 deaths related to dogs in actually the province in the last 30 years. Very few of them, one occurred in 2014, didn't make the news. But as we know, due to just the way that the media likes to pinpoint certain dogs or breeds or dogs with certain appearances as being the quote-unquote raison d'etre for deaths or dog bites in this specific case, because the dog did look a specific way, the media picked up on it, and it was something that became really an international sensation. People calling for a ban on quote-unquote pit bull type dogs, and the city of Montreal reacting, and then the province several months later introducing a bill at the National Assembly with similar breed-specific legislation components to it, as well as dealing with some other elements of dangerous dogs and dogs that have bitten or attempted to bite.
There's so many elements to unpack here. I think I want to take it by going through the legislative stuff that took place, because I know that there was, in a sense, a victory that took place in Montreal, but it's one of those situations where, I guess, winning the battle but perhaps losing the war. I believe, is it correct that Montreal enacted its bylaw first before Quebec?
Exactly. So yeah, the bylaw was enacted. You know, we knew that it was coming on September 27th, 2016. And, you know, we had prepared for this. So immediately after the bylaw was enacted, and we can talk about what that bylaw encompassed in terms of the breed-specific legislation, we, the Montreal SPCA, immediately filed an application for judicial review and stay, aiming to suspend the application and or the enforcement of the section of the bylaw targeting quote-unquote pit bull type dogs.
And what let's talk about that. What did the Montreal bylaw do exactly?
So the Montreal bylaw, grosso modo, did two things. One, it prohibited pit bull type dogs, and it defined pit bull type dogs as a dog belonging to one of the following breeds: American Pit Bull Terrier, which is actually not a breed even recognized in Canada, US, American Staffordshire Terrier, or Staffordshire Bull Terrier, any dog crossed with any of these breeds. And then this is sort of the big one, any dog that has physical or morphological traits of any of those breeds or any of the mixes of those breeds. And that is really wide, because when you start to break down in terms of dog genetics and DNA and physical characteristics, that pretty much means any dog could hypothetically fall under this definition. And so the bylaw prohibits ownership or guardianship of these dogs, however, with a what we call a grandfather clause. So anyone who currently had, if they could figure out whether or not the bylaw actually applied to their dogs, one of these dogs would be able to keep their dog, provided their dog was muzzled at all times while outdoors, that they purchased a special permit. If they had a criminal record, they would not be able to keep their dog. The license, the special license, was not transferable. And so this, of course, was extremely problematic, of course, for families who had dogs that were potentially targeted. Families had no idea whether or not their dogs fell under the bylaw. For those who had a DNA test or knew their dog was a purebred Staffordshire Terrier, they were all of a sudden subject to purchasing a very expensive license. They also had to have their dog sterilized, but responsible dog owners or guardians already do, muzzling their dogs at all times while outside, which of course led to neighbors and people in the public certainly acting differently towards them and their dogs. And what this bylaw meant for the Montreal SPCA and other shelters in Montreal is that we no longer could adopt out dogs that would be considered quote unquote pit bull type dogs. And for us, of course, because of the way that the bylaw was drafted, we would really have no idea to even know which dogs we wouldn't be able to adopt out. And of course, we're not prepared to euthanize behaviorally sound, healthy dogs simply because of the way that they look or because of the mix of breeds that they were.
So before we get into some of the shortcomings of this law, though you've touched on quite a few of them already, what was the SPCA response? You talked about obtaining an injunction, which I believe you were successful with at the first instance, correct?
Right. So at the first instance, you know, our argument was that the provisions of the bylaw targeting pit bull type dogs were contrary to several fundamental principles that govern the legality of municipal bylaws. We argued that it was discriminatory and ultra virus. So our Municipal Powers Act, which is the provincial legislation that governs what powers municipalities have, does not allow municipalities to make distinctions or to discriminate between regular dog owners and pit bull type dog owners. It also allows municipalities to eliminate stray or dangerous animals, but pit bull type dogs under the bylaw are neither considered dangerous or stray. They're just this type of dog that the bylaw tries to define and then says they're prohibited. So our first argument was that it was outside the powers of a municipality to adopt such a bylaw and that the bylaw was discriminatory. We also argued that it's contrary to provincial legislation. So we have a provincial animal protection law, as does every province, but we also have a civil code that recognizes that animals, including dogs, are sentient beings. So we argued that by requiring dogs to be muzzled at all times, by essentially requiring that adoptable and healthy dogs be put to death because they can't be adopted in Montreal, these provisions were inconsistent with both our Animal Welfare and Safety Act, as well as the provisions of the Civil Code that recognize animals as sentient beings and individuals. We also argued that the bylaw was vague and imprecise. So because of the definition of pit bull type dog, and essentially it's impossible, and there is a ton of excellent scientific literature on visual identification of breed dogs, essentially even experts are absolutely unable to tell a dog's breed by looking at them. And so, in fact, many dogs could fall under this definition of quote-unquote pit bull type dog without even having any of the three prohibited breeds in them, and that, you know, saying because a dog has a big head and pointy ears, they therefore are a specific breed is inherently unscientific, and it's impossible for anybody to know whether or not they or their dog would even be subject to the bylaw. We argue that it's contrary to procedural fairness principles, as well as being unreasonable and arbitrary, because there's no credible evidence to the effect that the dogs that are targeted are actually any more dangerous, or that they're inherently dangerous in any way, and that there's no way for anyone to challenge the part of the bylaw that stipulates that if, you know, an officer of the city of Montreal designates their dog as a pit bull type dog, there's no provisions that allow them to appeal or to contest that designation. So those were the principal arguments. And again, not all that different from some of the arguments we saw in the Ontario Court of Appeal and Superior Court case of Cochrane, but we were dealing with a municipal bylaw, and there's some pretty big differences between the case here and the Ontario case that maybe we can get into later. And ultimately, the Superior Court agreed with us, so we were successful at first instance, and there was a temporary suspension of all of the provisions dealing with quote-unquote pit bull type dogs targeting certain breeds, or the way that specific dogs look. And, you know, the Superior Court said that, you know, that's clearly the bylaw raises very serious legal questions, which the court would need to consider. And given, you know, the fact that it clearly was urgent by virtue of the fact that, you know, dogs could potentially be put to death, people would be forced to give up their dogs, that it was certainly on that basis acceptable to suspend those sections until such time as the merits of the case could be heard.
And it was, sorry, was that that injunction was, I recall the injunction was overturned, or am I incorrect in that?
It was, yes. Unfortunately, the Court of Appeal overturned in part. There were two concessions that the City of Montreal made. They agreed not to order any quote-unquote pit bull type dog to be euthanized, as well as made there was a prohibition on a stray dog that was considered a quote-unquote pit bull type dog being reclaimed by their owner. They agreed to, of their own volition, suspend temporarily those provisions, but the rest of, unfortunately, the provisions were then put into effect. So the Court of Appeal disagreed.
So let me just explain for some of our listeners, because there's a fair bit going on here. The idea of getting an interim injunction was essentially to put a stop immediately to this bylaw going into effect. So when Alana suggests that they won at first instance, it didn't mean that they actually won on the merits of whether or not this bylaw was legal or could be kept in place. It was essentially the court agreeing that there were serious enough issues to be tried that it was worth putting a suspension on the law so that the court could actually hear it. And similarly, when it went to the Court of Appeal, the municipality agreed to not use or not enforce certain aspects of the law. And again, that was a temporary measure, correct, Alana, until the actual issue could be litigated?
Exactly. It was the two temporary measure, and then unfortunately, the Court of Appeal, you know, overturned the Superior Court's decision, which lifted the temporary stay.
Now, as it turns out, you were able to, well, not you, but Quebecers were, or Montrealers were able to rectify this problem through the political process. Is that correct?
Exactly. I think it's always good to use multifaceted approaches to these issues. So certainly while we were, you know, looking at tackling this issue in court, at the same time, of course, there was, you know, looking at the political system, the fact that there were elections coming up, and The now mayor of Montreal, Valérie Plante, with Projet Montréal, had made a promise before she was elected mayor on November 5th to repeal the breed-specific components of the bylaw. And she was elected, and so the provisions were suspended and have been in suspension since December 20th, 2016. which is good news for Montreal and the war, but not the overall battle.
Or the battle and not the war. Okay, well, I want to get to the Quebec, and I obviously want to get to some of the issues in the appeal. And you mentioned the Cochrane case from Ontario, but before we get there, Alana, I feel like we have to get something out on the table. Pit bulls are big. They're scary. They kill people, Alana. What's wrong? Aside from, you know, let's assume for the moment I agree with your issue about the discriminatory aspect and not being able to tell who and what is a pit bull. But, I mean, come on, Alana. Shouldn't we be getting rid of these dogs?
Well, I think there's, you know, that's a very common thing to say. I mean, I think there's a few things when we get down to it, and there's a ton of literature on this issue. There have been countries and cities that have implemented breed-specific legislation, and it has been absolutely ineffective in reducing the risk or severity of dog bites. So it just doesn't work. That's the first thing. And it's for that reason that, you know, there are countries like the Netherlands that have had breed-specific legislation in effect and after years have reversed it because it simply has done nothing to, you know, to the bottom line, which is to make, you know, society safer for people. It just hasn't worked. And
the city of Calgary did the same thing too. Is that not correct? It was Calgary or Edmonton did the exact same thing.
Exactly. Calgary indeed has a model that certainly a lot of municipalities look to, which is for a long time was seen as really the sort of way to go in Canada, a breed neutral, education focused way of dealing with the issue of, you know, dangerous dogs and any irresponsible owners. And, you know, even in Ontario, what's really interesting is Ontario never kept a dog bite registry. So they actually didn't know how many dog bites there were before they adopted breed-specific legislation province-wide, and they actually don't know how many there are now. But a journalist looked into hospitalization rates post the adoption of breed-specific legislation in 2005 and actually found that the number of hospitalizations due to severe dog bites increased by 45%. So it certainly has not been effective in Ontario either.
Alana, stop quoting evidence. I mean, honestly, it's so much more effective to scaremonger, to tell people that pit bulls are really big and scary, isn't it? Like, it seems to me, I'm obviously being facetious, but it's one of the things that drives me crazy is that there's no real, it's again, and to be honest, if we wanted to here, we're going to talk about breed-specific legislation. But to me, this is a consistent theme of animal law in just about every sense that we want to take it. It is, we are going to take the easiest, most thoughtless sort of solution that we think can deal with the problem and try and make it go away. That is essentially the animal law at its core to me.
Yeah, I mean, it is really scary. And, you know, having testified at the National Assembly and seeing sort of the way that breed-specific legislation specifically played out here has played out elsewhere is, you know, you basically have every expert. So dog bite epidemiologists, veterinary behaviorists, veterinarians, animal law experts, every single possible, you know, the Center for Disease Control in the United States, every possible expert saying this does not work and explaining, again, it's complex, why it's wholly unscientific, why it will never work. And then you have, individuals with a specific agenda who, again, have this idea of putting fear into the community, as well as the media that really is to blame for this as well, because it makes for good stories saying, these dogs are killers, and when, again, there's no scientific basis for this whatsoever. There certainly are dogs with problematic behavior, but those dogs come in all different shapes and sizes, and the only difference in terms of quote-unquote dangerosity that really we can say amongst different breeds happens to do with size. So that's...
I will add, though, by the way, aside from size, what these dangerous dogs, we forgot, usually, not always, but usually have in common is an idiot owner attached to them. That's usually a common denominator between dogs that end up causing great harm to others. Not always, but often.
Very, very often. And I mean, there's, again, I won't get into quoting the science, but, you know, there have been some really interesting studies of like co-occurring factors in fatal dog bites. And you've got it, in terms of the quote unquote idiot owner. In a large majority of the cases, dogs are unsterilized. They've been subject to some form of neglect, abuse, or punishment-based training. Often they're dogs that have had aggressive behavior previously or even bitten previously. And that was the case, actually, in the city of Montreal. The dog involved in this woman's death, who, by the way, was named Lucifer, to give you an idea of the type of dog owner or guardian we were dealing with, had already bitten someone, put someone in the hospital. And the city of Montreal already had the tools with their existing municipal bylaw to do something about that dog. They could have seized the dog, had the dog evaluated, had the dog euthanized or taken other measures, and they failed to do so. So even the coroner's report, the coroner in the case of the woman that was killed, came out and pretty much said, had the city of Montreal done their job, this death could have been prevented, and pointed out clearly that the dog in this case had been neglected, abused, and was very, very much, as you mentioned, owned by someone who is an idiot owner, so to speak.
Yeah, and we, of course, place very few, if any, it depends on the jurisdiction, restrictions on dog ownership or dog licensing or what you have to do to own a dog. So as a result, it's not uncommon for people to have no clue with what they're doing with their animals and either letting them roam loose and setting them up in situations that are dangerous or, in worst case scenarios, the tie between dog attacks and animal abuse is usually, again, not always, but usually quite strong.
Yeah, it is. There certainly is very much a correlation, between neglect, abuse, and dogs that show dangerous behavior or end up biting.
Now, before we get to the Quebec law, I just want to tell you, like, everything you were saying, I've been through this rodeo before, excuse the animal pun, but unfortunately in New Zealand it was literally the exact same thing. There was a horrible case of a little girl who was mauled in a situation by, again, idiot dog owner who let their dog roam in a place where the dog shouldn't have been roaming, and it was like the newspapers made it their cause in life to get a dangerous dog law passed, and essentially they literally put her picture on the front page every day until Parliament convened and passed breed-specific legislation. It was just absolutely unbelievable. So I've seen this happen before. The evidence just got kicked to the wayside, and hostile sentiment just took over.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that in doing research, on this specific issue and finding out about other, fatal dog bites or attacks in Quebec, and something that blew my mind, and I guess didn't blow my mind in the sense of it's unfortunately a reality of the society we're living in, is that, in 2014, so not all that long ago, a little girl was killed in Quebec by a dog. The little girl was killed, was Indigenous, was killed on a reserve. The dog was identified as some sort of northern mix. Not one media article. Couldn't find any. I found a coroner's report, no media article. So this was probably the biggest story of the year, and that's not to take away from the tragedy of a woman losing her life and all the impacts on her family. But several years ago, there was on a reserve a four-year-old girl killed by a dog, and it didn't make a single newspaper article. And I think that just goes to show, unfortunately, the media bias in terms of covering issues, again, that can be sensationalized and that are going to be more appealing to their readers. And to me, that's sort of something that's been throughout all of this, that's been kind of weaved in, looking at what gets media attention and what doesn't in terms of, dog bites. There certainly is a correlation between whether or not the media can name the dog as being a dog that they can say is quote unquote dangerous, and certainly who the victim is and whether or not the media feels they can, make it interesting and have that be something that the public is going to pick up on. And I, again, was horrified, but I guess not really surprised to find out about this tragic death that had occurred in 2014, and not a word said about it in the media at all. I couldn't find anything except for a coroner's report.
Wow. All right, let's go back to where we were. You've got this wonderful election win in Montreal. Pit bulls are off the... I'll use pit bulls, as a general term, even though we know that's problematic in itself. But so pit bulls are off the proverbial chopping block in Montreal. Problem solved, correct, Alana?
Well, problem solved municipally, not so much provincially. After this death occurred, there was a first reading of a province-wide dangerous dog bill that included breed-specific legislation in April of 2017. However, we didn't hear anything about it. And over the first reading and then the National Assembly, the provincial government was quiet. And, you know, two things sort of just in terms of, again, not the, the scientific arguments and not in terms of the legal issues with respect to breed-specific legislation, but two things changed. One is there was certainly a large sentiment, even within the media, that, you know, part of the reason why Projet Montréal won in Montreal was in relation to their promises vis-a-vis animal issues, particularly breed-specific legislation. So a message, you know, to the provincial government saying, like, this is something you need to be considering with elections coming up. And the second thing is that the coroner's report came out and was published after the first reading of the legislation. And the coroner's report, again, this is, you know, the Quebec coroner comes out with reports on highly mediatized or highly, you know, problematic or difficult cases, and his sole or their sole purpose is really to look at the issues of public safety. And their very lengthy and extensive report said, you know, we recommend against breed-specific legislation. The provincial government is going in the wrong direction. Here's what we think you should do. So those were two things that we thought would, you know, put sort of a halt entirely on this bill moving forward. However, the provincial government, you know, several weeks ago announced that there would be specific consultations, which did take place at the National Assembly on Bill 128, which is this legislation that includes province-wide breed-specific legislation. And we were there. We presented a memo and spoke, and there were a number of other groups, mostly experts, but several, you know, victims, families, a group called, you know, the National Pit Bull Victim Awareness Association, again, not providing anything really scientific, but rather, you know, statistics pulled from media reports, which are obviously highly inaccurate, and some very sort of scary sounding stories and photos. But again, it goes to show, you know, and the government certainly seems to understand that this is an issue where that's highly polarized, but they don't seem to be looking specifically at the scientific issues and what the experts have to say.
So let me ask you two questions about that. First of all, when do you think we'll have some idea of whether, you know, the government has been swayed to move away from this the breed-specific legislation?
It's hard to say because we have provincial elections coming up in November. And just given looking at the calendar of the National Assembly, and I think, again, looking to the fact that in the Liberal government that are currently a majority government understand how much of an issue this could be for election time, I suspect that they won't move forward with a second reading of this bill before the election. So Bill 128, at least in its current form, and the current proposal for province-wide breed-specific legislation, I think will die with this current government period in power, and then it'll depend on who is elected, you know, if there's a majority or minority government, who is elected after the elections in November. The problem being that all three parties, there's one smaller party that's been somewhat silent and seems to be opposed to breed-specific legislation, but all three major parties in the province have spoken out in favor of breed-specific legislation. So I certainly will not be surprised if once there's, you know, again, there's 450 dog bites a day in Quebec, it's going to be easy for the media to find a specific case where they can say, you know, it's this dog is the problem. I wouldn't be surprised when there's another case that makes it to the media that we don't find ourselves, even after the elections, with a new bill that has some form of breed-specific legislation, even with a different government after November, or if this Liberal government is you know, again in power with either a majority or a minority.
Now, you mentioned, we talked a little earlier about the Cochrane decision, and I guess that's where I wanted to go with this last part, is talking about what happens if they do enact. It seems to me that the ability to challenge on the provincial level, as you indicated earlier, is much more complex than challenging at the municipal level, because the provincial government has a lot more constitutional authority to do what it wants in this area. Could you briefly tell me, like, how detrimental is Cochrane, which is the decision trying to challenge Ontario's decision, the unsuccessful attempt to challenge Ontario's breed-specific legislation? What do you see in that decision? Do you think there are avenues legally to argue against any law of this type?
You know, I think, listen, it certainly would be, you know, we've talked about this extensively, and a very uphill battle. Again, we're dealing with, you know, much broader powers with respect to what the provincial government can and can't do. You're looking at, you know, not administrative law. You're looking at really constitutional arguments. The municipal bylaw in Montreal, at least, was drafted in such a way that it was extremely broad, whereas the provincial legislation that's being proposed with respect to the definition of quote-unquote pit bull uses pretty much the definition from Cochrane. So it looks like the provincial government said, we're going to do what the Ontario government did, because we know, you know, that this would certainly be an uphill battle for anyone challenging the legislation. You know, without going into all the details, because there are, you know, I think for your listeners, there are a number of pretty complex constitutional issues. You know, one of the areas where I do see, again, a potential area for challenge, and where I see there being some difference just in terms of how, you know, evidence has evolved between 2005 and you know, now 13 years later, is, you know, one of the areas where in Cochrane the provincial legislation was challenged was, you know, with respect to Section 7. So, you know, Section 7 comes into play because it was triggered, and it's, for your listeners, it's everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person, and the right not to be deprived thereof, except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. It's triggered because there was a potential term of imprisonment from conviction under the Act. So that's how Section 7 is triggered. And one of the arguments with the Section 7 is that, you know, legislation can't be overbroad overbreath. It means that the legislation can't be disproportionate to the reach. What needed to be demonstrated in order to show that there was an issue with respect to overbreath or Section 7 is that the applicant, so Cochrane, needed to show that the legislature did not have a basis for a reasoned apprehension of harm from quote-unquote pit bulls, or that action taken by the legislature was grossly disproportionate to the risk posed by pit bulls. And what the Court of Appeal ultimately held was that there was sufficient evidence of what they called a reasoned apprehension of harm to allow the legislature to act. So even though they said there was conflicting evidence, there wasn't enough evidence, there was enough to say that, you know, pit bulls could potentially be a problem, and it was open to the legislature to be able to restrict the ownership of pit bulls, and that, you know, there wasn't any conclusive data. I think one of the differences here is that because VSL has been such an issue worldwide, there is so much more peer-reviewed scientific literature on the issue of breed-specific legislation, its effectiveness, and specifically on the issue of dangerousness of certain types or breeds of dogs versus other dogs. And again, I think the scientific evidence is a lot stronger. And in fact, I don't think there's any scientific evidence, again, from those who have expertise in dog bite epidemiology or in dog behavior, to say that quote-unquote pit bulls are in any way, shape, or form dangerous. So I think there could be something interesting, at least with respect to a Section 7 argument and overbreath, if the legislation, again, had a possibility of imprisonment for a violation, or a possibility of imprisonment for not paying a fine in virtue of the legislation, and we could argue a Section 7 argument, you could argue overbreath. And I think even though, again, facing an uphill battle because of Cochrane, and again showing this, that, you know, the uphill battle of showing that the action taken by the legislature was grossly disproportionate and that there isn't any basis for this reasoned apprehension of harm, I think the scientific evidence is certainly a lot stronger in favor of showing that there is just no basis for legislation prohibiting these dogs across the province. So that would be one area I think we'd focus on.
Well, I would also add that the jurisprudential basis is better for you now than it was then. I think there's no question that Cochrane was decided at a time, not to get too constitutionally nerdy for our listeners, but it was decided at a time when the overbreadth and gross disproportionality doctrines were pretty barren. It had been a series of losses for people of all sorts going up. And since that time, two notable cases from the Supreme Court on completely different issues, the prostitution case, obviously, and the case involving euthanasia, have both, in my mind, strengthened the overbreadth doctrines and given a little bit more impetus and willingness on the courts to look at evidence. So I think that would also be of use in sort of challenging the mindset of Cochrane.
Absolutely. So yeah, you know, I think that would be the area we would be focusing on. There are certainly some other arguments that we're brainstorming about and looking into, arguments that weren't even raised in Cochrane. So I don't think, and again, we're at the brainstorming phase, so I don't think now is necessarily a time for me to be able to share it with your listeners. But, you know, for us, we know it would be an uphill battle. And so, of course, while we're also looking at any potential legal arguments, should there be province-wide green pieces of legislation adopted, we're very much working on the political side as well, and trying to get our legislative body to actually understand they should be looking at the evidence and looking for a real solution to address the issue of dog bites and dangerous dogs, and that breed-specific legislation is, you know, not only unfair, it's going to be extremely costly. There's going to be serious collateral damage to both people and dogs, and that it's ultimately, you know, unenforceable and unscientific. So for us, that's our focus right now. But of course, we're keeping, in the back of our minds that should we end up facing province-wide breed-specific legislation, absolutely looking at as to whether or not there are any ways to challenge the legislation. And again, we're thinking about this in a creative manner as possible is something that we're keeping in mind.
Well, we wish you the very best of luck in your work in this, Alana. I know you're doing great work out there. And I also know you are the personal owner of a few dogs who would probably fall into this legislation. So I just wanted to pass on that if this does go south in Quebec, we will extend a hearty invitation to you and your dogs to come join us here in Edmonton so you can continue your good work out here in Alberta, where for the moment we have no prejudice against any type of dog.
Thanks so much, Peter, thank you for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
Heroes and Zeros.
All right, everybody, welcome back to everybody's favorite segment, Heroes and Zeros. Now, Camille, I have to tell you, I've been saying this ever since we started, that it's everybody's favorite topic. I have to give a shout out. I got an email from Victoria Schroff in Vancouver, and she said, please also tell Camille that Heroes and Zeros is my favorite segment of the podcast. So there you go.
Well, I'm glad we finally have some evidence to support your claim. Thanks,
we
Victoria.
We are an evidence-based podcast. Unlike the Minister of Justice, we like to make our decisions based on the evidence. Ba-dum-bum.
No fake news over here.
No fake news. We are going to talk about heroes and zeros.
All right. Well, Peter,
who's leading off? Do you want to lead off with hero or zero? We always lead off with hero. You want to lead off with zero this time, and then we'll end it off on a good note, Camille?
Well, sure. Why not mix it up a little bit? All right.
Let's mix it up. Camille, why don't you tell us about the zero of the month?
All right. So the zero this month, we're giving the zero award to a Revelstoke petting zoo that's facing 24 animal cruelty charges after 15 animals were seized from the property back in June. And they were seized over lack of food and water and veterinary care. So apparently when the BCSPCA showed up, they found one dead pig, 3 live pigs, 5 horses, 2 mini horses, a lamb, an alpaca, a goat, and a peacock. And I'm not sure if charges were laid in relation to all of these animals or most of them or what. But the reason, you know, obviously it's terrible that these animals were suffering, and I'm so glad that the BCSPCA was able to step in and fix that situation. But we wanted to use this award, the Zero Award, as a way to highlight that even something that seems as innocuous as a petting zoo or trail riding operation can actually be pretty horrific for animals. And Peter, I know you have this rule where if you think something might be bad, it's actually 10 times worse for animals. I think that really applies in this case. When animals are being used for profit, there is an inevitable temptation in some respect to cut corners on their welfare to increase those profits. And I think that's exactly the kind of situation that may have led to these cruelty charges.
Yeah, absolutely. I do believe in that mantra that things are usually much, much worse than you believe that they are. And I think these types of operations often have a lot of cruelty behind the scenes. We know certainly of some of these zoos that have been put out of business, thankfully, but there are plenty more of them in operation. Camille, can I ask, when you say these are animal cruelty charges, I always like to get specific. Are we talking provincial or federal?
Well, the... The article that I read, it was a CBC.ca article of the BC. It didn't specify whether they were federal or whether they were criminal charges or provincial, but they do quote the chief inspector of the BCSPCA as saying that there could be a penalty imposed of up to 5 years in prison. So it suggests to me that at least some of those charges are criminal in nature. There's also a mention of a potential $75,000 fine, which is something under the provincial statute. So in this case, I suspect that there's a mix.
Yeah, okay. Sounds about right. I always like when they go federal because I want them to go after everybody. I'm not sure if the zoo is an incorporated body, but I'd like them to take everybody down. It sounds to me like when something is that bad, you got to take it all down.
Yeah, totally. Throw it to the wall.
Let's focus on something more positive, because really, I think this is about as positive a story as you can get from a negative story, because the story itself is terrible, but I think it's a positive hero. And our hero of the month is Faisal Ullah, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Faisal Ullah out of Australia, who is a navigation officer. If you are following the news on animal law, this is the biggest story as there is right now. He exposed unbelievable cruelty and videoed on a recent live export ship out of Australia called the Awasi Express that was headed to the Middle East. And the facts of this case are absolutely horrific. And essentially, as often happens in live sheep export, you have incredible amounts of death and suffering. And what's fantastic is that Faisal Ullah risked his own job to bring this to the people. And this has caused quite an uproar in Australia, has it not, Camille?
Oh, yeah. It was on 60 Minutes, which is their big news outlet. And just from what I can tell, the expose has provoked a pretty strong government response, too. But they showed just awful conditions. Sheep crammed together in squalid, hot quarters. Apparently, they are not supposed to have pregnant sheep on board, but they did anyway. And so when those lambs were born, the newborn lambs had their throats slit and thrown overboard. Apparently, in one day, something like 1,200 sheep died of heat stroke, essentially. They're basically in an oven, and somewhere in the Persian Gulf, it got so hot that they baked to death. And their carcasses were tossed into the sea. And understandably, the government itself is actually under a lot of pressure to respond to this. And I'm hearing that the minister has actually directed an investigation into his own department's capabilities and culture after the Ministry of Agriculture failed to find any breaches of Australian rules.
Well, because it's so ridiculous. I mean, I've been following this story. I, of course, used to live in that part of the world, and I've been following this story for years, and this isn't the first time. Right. We've had this story. This is a second redo of this story. And every time the industry, guess what, Camille, blames it on rogue, ships that didn't follow the rules as required. And we just need to tighten up those rules. And what we see again and again and again is sheep dying. The history of sheep live export, I'm going to tell you, is as bad as anything I have ever seen in any culture, just about anywhere. It's really absolutely terrible. You're talking about, first of all, the cruelty is endemic. What we're seeing in these cases is worst case scenarios, slitting the throats of newborn lambs, throwing them overboard. It's all terrible. But what we're talking about is conditions where the sheep are almost inevitably going to suffer. It is a terrible situation from the moment they are herded up and transported, you know, across vast distances to get on these ships, and they have to sit there, and there are ventilation issues and feed issues. It's just, everybody knows this, and yet we continue to paint this as something that, well, it can be regulated. We'll put a vet on board. I mean, the idea of having a vet on board, there are 1,200 sheep dying. It's just, it's so ludicrous what's going on here. And thankfully, the animal advocacy groups in Australia are doing a wonderful job bringing this to the people and really trying to show how problematic this is. And I want to give a shout out to my good friend who works with the SPCA in Australia, Jed Goodfellow, who's done a tremendous job. Those of you, I suggest, if you want to learn more about this, just follow Jed Goodfellow on Twitter. He has been tweeting about this nonstop. And it is just fantastic, the work that's being done there. And let's hope it really makes a difference. Let's hope it doesn't just die down like it does sometimes, and we just move on to something else.
Yeah, I hope not. And shout out to Animals Australia as well for all their work on this. But you're right, the Australians have done a really good job at keeping this in the news, and I really hope they do continue, because like you said, Peter, this isn't a matter of just imposing better regulations, blaming ineffective employees or poor training. This is a practice that is inherently abusive, inherently cruel, is going to cause suffering no matter which way you cut it, and just has to frankly stop.
That's why I always look at this. I call these bellwether issues. Essentially, it's sort of like a rodeo. Like, if we can't knock these issues out, it's very hard to move down the chain and get to issues that are, in a sense, less guaranteed to result in suffering. And I think that when you have situations this bad, it's just essential to say, look, we're not going to take it anymore. And every time you get a ban of this type, just like the Israeli foie gras ban, it signals a willingness to sometimes say profit cannot govern. And that is, to me, the biggest thing we need to do if we're going to move animal interests forward in this world.
Hear, hear. So shout out to Faisal Ula for exposing this. I'm sure that took a lot of courage, but it's going to make a difference.
All right, we got some Q&A this week, Camille. We got some questions and answers, and I'm going to start by asking you a question, Camille, because it's really directed to you. This is from Debbie Wall, and she asked, Camille, you said you were making a presentation and would be explaining what animal justice does on a day-to-day basis. I, too, would be curious to know. Camille, what does animal justice do on a day-to-day basis?
Well... Okay, so as the executive director of Animal Justice, I feel like my day is probably less legally focused than a lot of people would expect. We're still a pretty small team. We've got two full-time staff members and a couple of people who work part-time as well. So in practice, I'm responsible for all the campaigns, oversight over them and doing most of the work on many of them. Anna Pippis manages our farmed animal campaigns. I'm also responsible for all of the back end stuff that happens on, like this gala, like our Christmas party that we hold, like our fundraising, like emailing communications to supporters and making sure we keep everybody in the loop about what we're doing. These days, I've been working a lot on one court case in particular. I'm sure we'll do an episode about it at some point, but we're about to file an application to intervene in a case where there's a constitutional challenge to Ontario's animal protection legislation. So that's been a lot of work. Sometimes the day kind of changes midday. So maybe an animal cruelty issue comes up in the news and suddenly the Globe and Mail wants me to write an op-ed for them about the case. Maybe I'll just shelve everything I was working on and start writing for the Globe, which is always exciting.
Absolutely.
So it's a really diverse and varied day. We've got Shannon Milling, who's our podcast producer and our communications manager. She spends a lot of time worrying about our social media, worrying about the emails that are going out, doing graphic design. So there's a lot of sort of unglamorous stuff that happens in the background. But overall, every single day is different. And every single day is tons of fun because you never know what's going to come. But you always know it's making a difference for animals.
Absolutely, which is why animal justice always needs your support. If you're listening to this podcast, we really do need your support. If we're going to make changes for animals, I can't tell you how many things we want to do. And I can also tell you how difficult it is to do all those things. Our poor Camille is being worked to the bone and needs help. And I say that without joking. It's amazing. We are essentially blessed to have someone who's willing to work as hard as she does. Because like, I'm not. And it's a good thing that Camille's willing to do all these things, because otherwise we wouldn't have this amazing organization doing all these things. So we always need your help, frankly, if we're going to move animal justice forward.
Yeah, we want to keep growing and doing even more things for animals. So, mostly, though, I feel just grateful every single day that I get to do this work. I went to law school because I wanted to be an animal rights lawyer, and that doesn't always pan out for a lot of people who have that dream. It requires a lot of effort, and I'm just so lucky to have all of the colleagues and supporters that we've got and that we're changing the legal landscape for animals. So, thanks for that question, Debbie. Debbie actually has another question, Peter, that I think I'm going to throw over to you. You can put on your law professor hat and give a little bit of an explanation about this one. But Debbie has a question about precedents. Could you, Peter, please explain what they are in layman terms and whether they are written in stone once they're set? So what's a precedent?
Oh, God. Well, this is like a full lecture usually in a law school class. So I'm going to try and put this into the 5-minute version for you, Debbie. What is a precedent? We live in a system, what is called a common law system, whereby parts of our law are essentially made by judges. And these judges make decisions in what are called rulings or judgments. And the way in which these judgments works is there is a common law, legal principle that is known by its Latin term, stare decisis. And stare decisis means, effectively, that you should follow the decision of higher courts that are binding upon you. And these are what is known as precedents. Essentially, what it means is that decisions that are made by courts should be followed by other courts unless they are overruled. So to put it in the simplest terms, when the Supreme Court makes a decision that is called a precedent, other judges are not simply free to disregard that precedent and make their own legal determination. They have to follow the finding of the higher court. And that's what a precedent effectively is. It effectively sets the law for lower courts and says, you must follow this. Are they written in stone? That's where things get really complicated for two reasons. One is that a decision is only binding insofar as it goes, which means that if the finding does not actually extend to exactly the same situation as the one you're dealing with, it's not completely binding. Second of all, are they written in stone? Not entirely. Courts can, if they are of the same level as that court, so for example, if the Alberta Court of Appeal makes a decision, the Ontario Court of Appeal does not have to follow it, and they can change decisions of their own courts. So the Supreme Court often revises what it is that it's saying about a particular subject. In short, I wouldn't say they are written in stone, but the tradition of the courts is generally to follow precedents that are written until those precedents are reversed. So when we get hit with an adverse precedent in the common law, we have to be careful about that going forward. And just to put this into very concrete terms, you can think about the situation we dealt with a while back in Newfoundland when we were talking about the decision of the Newfoundland court to treat a dog as a piece of property and not look at it in a more holistic way. That decision is binding on lower courts in Newfoundland, so you will no longer be able to bring a case in Newfoundland saying, well, we should, you know, look at this puppy in a different way. However, we also talked in that case about a dissenting judgment from that court that was very powerful. So, for example, there is no binding precedent in, say, Alberta. So you could bring a case in Alberta and say, well, we want you to follow the decision of the dissenting judge in that court. That's very possible and something that happens all the time. So precedents are both fixed and flexible, if that makes any sense. And if it doesn't make any sense to you, Debbie, trust me, it takes my law students months to get it as well.
Well, good job condensing a 2-hour lecture into about 5 minutes, Peter. But, you know, one thing I would add, there's something that's kind of cool about precedents, which is that they do change in response to social norms. That's the beauty of the common law system. So in the 1990s, maybe it's not a common law norm that we care about animals or treat them compassionately in certain ways that might be more specific than I'm sort of laying out right now. But let's say we bring a case in 2018 and a higher court decides, yeah, we're just going to change the law in a way that we think responds to social norms, that becomes the new precedent. So, you know, there's pros and cons to it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thanks, Debbie, for your questions. We really appreciate them. And everybody, please keep those questions coming. We're always happy to answer what you want to know about animals and the law. We'd like to thank all our listeners for tuning in. Please, a reminder, you can subscribe to the Paw and Order podcast using iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcatcher. And please, please leave us a rating and a review, which helps us reach more people.
You can also share the podcast so that others have the opportunity to listen to it. And we always welcome donations to Animal Justice, which makes Paw and Order possible.
You can find me on Twitter at Peter Sankoff, on Facebook at Professor Sankoff, and at my website, petersankoff.com.
And you can find me online on Twitter at Camille Lavchuk, same handle on Instagram. And we always enjoy Twitter conversations about the show or any other animal law or political topics. And finally, thank you so much to our producer, Shannon Milling.
See you next time on Paw and Order.